Hello and welcome to my Fuzz and Talk for 2022. I am Maarten. I am a senior Python developer at Edemian, and I have been doing Python for a little over a decade. What is it I want to show you today? Well, during my missions at clients, I kept running into the same problem, and at one point, I just decided to write a little tongue-in-cheek library as a way to vent some frustration. I thought it turned out to be a pretty neat piece of code, so yeah, I guess that's what I want to show you today. Before we dive into the code, let me try and explain the problem a little bit. Let's say we've opened a burger shop and I want to write a application where I can place some orders for said burgers. So let's quickly make the web application. Now, do note, there are a lot of libraries with which you can write web application, but let's go for Flask for this one. So here you can see classic Flask application. We make a Flask app. We assign some configuration values. Here it's the time it will take to bake an actual burger. We flag a function as our endpoint, and then we emulate the baking of the burgers by putting some time sleeps. And we're done. We have a Flask application where I can order some burgers. Now, the people who have worked with web applications will notice that this is a very suboptimal solution because it will take a very, very long time for the request to return to the client. And yeah, this doesn't really contribute to a pleasant user experience. So what can we do in these situations? Usually when you have a piece of code that takes a long time to execute or is long running, what we do is we move that piece of code to an asynchronous job or task. Basically, you make it run in a different process and then you return to your client immediately saying, I have received your request and I am currently in the process of dealing with it. So let's do the same here. We'll use celery because this allows us to flag functions as asynchronous tasks. It's pretty straightforward as well if you've already worked with it. We just make a celery application. We add some celery configuration to the Flask application and then use the Flask app to initialize the celery app. We flag a function as the function to be an asynchronous task. And we move the long-running piece of code to this task. And voila, we have added celery to the mix. Now, our business is going well and we want to open another shop on the other side of town. And obviously I can use the same application for this, but there's a slight problem. The new building has better equipment and the bake time of the burgers is cut in half. Luckily, the bake time is just a configuration value and I can just adapt it where and when needed. So let's just give the bake time as an argument when we start the process. Now, I don't want to move my Flask initialization to the main block because it will get cluttered very fast, very soon. So I've moved it to a function where I create a Flask application. It takes some parameters and then I can initialize the app with dynamic configuration variables. Now, this does bring another problem, is that I can no longer use the app to initialize my celery application because it's no longer in the module scope, but has been moved to a function scope. So what I'll do is I'll move the initialization of the celery app to its own function. It'll take the Flask app as a parameter, and now I can just make the Flask application first, give it to the celery app, and they are both created in their own scope. Now, this does mean I no longer have access to the celery app to flag my functions as asynchronous tasks, which is a bit of a problem, but seeing as this is a small piece of code, I'll just shuffle some code around and I'll get there eventually. But imagine this kind of problematic in a larger code base where your tasks are spread over multiple modules, you want to have like a more complex config loading. It makes things a bit more complicated. There are several ways we can approach this problem and try to solve it. The most obvious one is to dance with the import order, but we all know how that goes. We have to be very aware of what we import when we're developing. And sooner or later, someone will run an isort on the code base and the entire CI will blow up. We can also do a deep dive into the code bases of Flask and Celery, And yeah, subclass, make changes as needed. It's very time consuming, but also a rewarding solution. Alternatively, we could monkey patch the hell out of these classes. Another solution is shared tasks, but we're not really writing a framework and we want to bind these tasks to an application for reasons. None of these solutions really feel clean, and yeah, each solution comes with their own set of problems. So wouldn't it be fun if we could just postpone statements? The problem here is that we're in some sort of dependency lock where we need to force a certain execution order in order to have things set up properly. But what if we had something that could defer statements until a real subject came available? Something that records what we have done and then replace it onto the object when it has been made available. How about something like this? How would we implement something like this? We can't really make one variable assume the identity of another or hijack the reference without tampering with the virtual memory. So we don't want to go down that route. The easiest way to achieve something like this is actually by using some sort of wrapper proxy object. And this object would then have two states. A suspended state where it will record anything you do with it, and an unsuspended state where it will kind of act like a proxy object forwarding anything that has been done with it to the actual subject. So we'll have something that records the actions done. It will assume the identity of what is supposed to be the celery instance. And then once the actual celery instance is available, we can replay what was recorded onto the celery instance. At least that's the idea. Let's dive into how this would work behind the scenes. Before we continue, it might be interesting to note that for the rest of the presentation, you can just forget about web application and synchronous tasks. It was just a means to an end to kind of explain the problem. We are not really here to talk about web applications or asynchronous tasks, so forget about it. Let's have a look at an actual example of how things would play out with this recorder instance. The piece of code on the screen again shows you how the function would be flagged as a task. The celery instance is not yet available, meaning our recorder object is still in a suspended state, and as such, it is recording. So we'll start with our fake celery instance, which is in fact an instance of a deferred class. I'll talk about deferred class a little bit later. And let's have a look at our decorator statement and follow the order of our operations there. The first thing that will happen is the accessing of the task attribute on the recorder. So the action that we'll be recording here is the get attribute. The get attribute takes a key to load, which in this case is the task. And the result of this call will be a new deferred instance being the task instance, or at least what's supposed to be at some point the actual task subject. But since it's not available yet, we'll have it act as a deferred instance in this case. Next, we'll be doing a function call on the task with a parameter myTask, just to give the task a name, which will also result in a new deferred because the subject is still not available. And so we are still in a recording state. And the next operation that will play out is the decorator. This will result in another call. It will do a call on the result of the task function call. So that means we'll do a call on the deferred object. And this again will result in a new deferred. So in the end, we'll end up with four deferred instances ending the chain. So the result of this statement, of this decorator statement, is that your module will be populated with a function called bake some burgers, but it will not be a function. It will be a deferred instance. This also means that anything you do with this function is recorded as well, but this is not part of this slide. So let's have a look at how this would work once the subject becomes available. If the subject becomes available, this means that we'll make the deferred instance unsuspended, meaning it's no longer recording, but it will switch towards a more proxy-like behavior. So if we take a look at the some burgers instance, which is still deferred, but has a subject available, we can see how that plays out when we call the delay function. So basically what will happen is we will ask the deferred instance to load the delay attribute. The deferred instance will then know, okay, I'm no longer suspended. I have a subject. I can ask my subject. They are asking me for a delayed attribute. Can you give it to me so that I can return it? So basically what you would then have as a return is the actual task delay attribute, which is then afterwards called, triggering the asynchronous job. Now, your deferred object kind of sounds like a mock object, no? Yeah, you could be right. It's able to deal with anything you throw at it, and it just returns a new instance of itself for every action you do. Now, if you don't know what a mock object is, it's a tool used in unit testing. And basically, it doesn't matter what you throw at it, you always get a mock instance back. When unit testing, it could be useful to mock out various parts of your code. For instance, when you call like a third-party API, because in your unit test, you obviously don't want to call the actual third-party API. So yes, the deferred instance kind of sounds like a mock object, where you are able to throw anything at it, and it will give you a new instance of the deferred object. But there are some steps that I would like to take differently. Because according to me, mock has one major flaw for something that is supposed to gracefully accept anything you throw at it, and that is reserved attributes. To set up your test, you interact directly with the mock object. For instance, whatever you assign to the return value will be returned as the value when you call the mock as a function. Same goes for assertion. If you want to assert something happened, you do it on the mock object itself. And then you can also initialize a mock object with predetermined values of any attribute you can think of, except name, because that is, of course, a reserved attribute. People working with mock will have undoubtedly run into this trap in their career. Initializing a mock with the name keyword and then accessing said attribute will result in a new mock object, whereas we would expect it to return the test string. So as you can see, these reserved attributes sometimes throw a wrench in your testing plans. In my opinion, you want to have some sort of handler object or function that interacts with these kind of objects. Because obviously, on an object that is supposed to accept anything you throw at it, you don't want to do any reserved attributes because who knows, somebody might need it. So these handler functions would then interact with your mock object to set or get information as you would need it. This is the step I want to take with my deferred object. I don't want any reserved keywords. I just want it to be able to handle anything I throw at it. So what would I need to get this recording library working? Well, as we've discussed, the deferred object that, when in a suspended state, returns a new instance of a deferred object. And when it is unsuspended, it would act as a proxy for the subject. Next to that, we also need a recorder that tracks the operation on the suspended deferred objects. And lastly, as discussed in the previous slide, we'll need some sort of handler that is able to interact with these deferred objects without having us to impose reserved attributes. So let's have a look at building a deferred object first. This deferred object will have a reference to the recorder, a reference to the future subject, and we'll put it in a suspended state by default. Now, this is where it gets interesting, and I hope I haven't lost you already, but here is where the fun starts. So before I continue, let's have a quick look at the get attribute versus the get attr, as there are some important differences, and knowing the difference will help us further down the line. Whenever you access an object attribute, in most cases, Python will run the get attribute method that is defined on the object. It will do a lookup of the attributes available on the object, and if it is found, returns the value associated with it. Now don't worry, you don't need to implement this yourself. Python does this natively for you, but you are able to override this get attribute if you want to change the default behavior. Anyway, whenever you do something like instance.attribute, the get attribute is run. If you're trying to access an attribute that is not part of the instance, it will raise an attribute error signaling that there is no such attribute. Then Python will do one of two things. It will check the class that it is interacting with to see if a getAttr is implemented, and if it does, it calls it and returns the value. It's important to note that getAttr is not implemented by default, and as such will only be called if the developer actually implemented it. And if the getAttr is not implemented, Python will just re-raise the attribute error. So when you want to change the behavior of how you want your attributes to be accessed, you usually want to go for the getAtter, because this was the intended place for developers to manipulate attribute accessing behavior. The reason for this is because it allows you to interact with self. Any interactions done with the self will result in the get attribute gracefully loading the attribute and returning the value. If you've played with overriding get attributes, you'll know that interacting with self in the get attribute will result in a recursion error, but we'll get into that a bit further down the line. But seeing as we're building an object that is able to deal with anything you throw at it, we really want to override the get attribute. So let's start implementing our special behavior. So the easiest scenario we can think of is the fact that the object is unsuspended, meaning that it acts as a proxy. And as you can see here, we just get a key from the subject and return that value. Simple proxy object, nothing fancy about that. Then the other case is when we are suspended. In that case, we want to make a new deferred instance, give it our recorder, and then return this new deferred instance. As you can see, we're also caching our return value, just in case you access the same attribute multiple times. But hey, wait a minute. Didn't you just say we couldn't access the self in the get attribute? Yes, you are right. So let's have a look at how we can circumvent recursion errors, allowing us to interact with self as if you would in any other method. Let's consider this piece of code. Making an instance of this object and then trying to access an attribute will result in a recursion error, because accessing the self.mapping will trigger a get attribute call, which in turn will try to access the mapping attribute, which will trigger yet another get attribute call that will also try to access the mapping attribute, and so forth. So what can we do to prevent this? We could run the parent get attribute, breaking the recursion, but you never know who or what will subclass this code. So usually I prefer to go to the roots and have the padre of it all handle it for me, the object.get attribute. But I, like many other programs, am a big fan of neat code, and as such, plastering my code with object.getAttribute self mapping is not something I want to do. So what if we had some kind of wrapper object that lets us interact with the self as if you were in any other method? So here you can see a small utility wrapper class. You can give it an instance of something, and whenever you interact with this utility wrapper, it calls the object's get attribute. The keen eyes will have noticed the accessible decorator a few slides back. This is a decorator that allows us to accept the normal self, which in turn wraps it in this utility wrapper. And now interacting with this wrapper will make it feel as if we're interacting with the self of any other method. I hope I haven't lost you so far, so let's do some easier stuff now. Now that we have the deferred object as good as done, we can start writing our recorder. What we'll need here is pretty basic: a list of records, a list of deferred objects, but we do have some requirements. Each action should be recorded and played as it was executed. This means that whenever a new deferred instance is created as a result of an action, it should pass the recorder to the new instance to ensure that we can keep a correct sequence of actions. We also want to keep track of all the deferred instances so that we can unsuspend them at a later time, which means we only have one recorder instance per patient zero deferred. So now that we have our recorder, we obviously want some kind of record object as well. It's pretty straightforward. We keep a reference to the deferred object on which the action was done. We keep the actual action. We'll store the arguments and the keyword arguments with which this action was invoked. And then we'll also store the deferred instance that was created by this action. On top of this, we'll also make some sort of utility decorator that we can plug into our deferred class, which will automatically record anything we do to it. Here as well, we'll only record if the deferred instance is in a suspended state. When this is the case, we'll make a record instance with the attributes we previously described. It is interesting to note that this record decorator is used alongside the accessible decorator, and as such, the self here is a true side wrapped deferred object, the true side being the utility object we talked about previously. If we didn't do that, we would be interacting with the deferred object directly, resulting in us creating a gigantic amount of deferred objects, which is obviously not what we want. If you remember the bit about the problem I had with mock is where we needed some sort of handler object, then this TrueSight object is just that. Because in this piece of code, we want to interact with the innards of the deferred object and not with the deferred object itself. So now we have records, we are able to record. Let's have a look at how we can play them. Pretty straightforward here. When the subject is ready and we want to play onto it, we can just loop over all the records that were made and perform them. Performing them is easy. You just get the action that you're supposed to do on the subject. If you remember, like getting an attribute or doing an actual call is the action. So you could imagine that the action here is like underscore get attribute or underscore call or underscore set attribute, those kind of things. So we have our deferred objects. We have a way to record. Now all we need is some sort of handler object that will function as a factory in making these deferred objects. It will also act as a handler object for when you want to replay what we've recorded. The code itself is pretty standard, but we did slightly deviate from the proof of concept code discussed at the start of the presentation. What we'll do here is we'll absorb the deferred object, resulting in a fed mimic. This fed mimic can then be used to replay the actions as if it were the real celery object. It also reads a bit clearer if we do it like this, because then you can say my mimic absorb my recording as if it were a celery app. By performing this statement, the real celery object will now be up to speed with all the actions that were done on the recording. Another result is that the deferred objects have also been set to unsuspended for the rest of the program. This means that for the rest of the program, they will function as proxies for their subjects. So that kind of concludes all the building blocks we need for this library. But as I mentioned, this library was a tongue-in-cheek library that allowed me to vent a bit of frustration. I've had a lot of fun writing this library, but now comes the time where I say that this library is actually not a viable solution for our initial problem. So now I'll take a bit of time to go over the reasons why this is the case. Firstly, it's an entire new avenue for introducing bugs. I wrote a library, I know it's not always easy to keep track of what's going on, and I can already assure you that you'll be scratching your heads when you have to solve bugs that involve the deferred object. It also hinders the readability, like there's no way around it. When reading the code, you have to be very aware of, is this object in a suspended state? Has it already been unsuspended? Am I interacting with a deferred? Am I interacting with a real object here? It really obfuscates the code and adds another layer of complexity. In the same vein, it kind of hinders your ability to follow the execution flow. And since Python is a language that allows you to do a lot of exotic things, you don't always have control over how things are implemented on the objects you are deferring, meaning that some unknown side effects may pop up. And then, and this is probably the most important contrapoint, this library doesn't really promote good software design. That's why the library comes with a big fat disclaimer. If you're ever in a situation where you're considering using this library, it's probably a good time to reevaluate your project structure, because you'll get much more value in restructuring your repository in a way that makes sense than using mimics. So you might ask yourself, why did you write it then? Well, mostly for fun. I think it's a neat piece of code with a good amount of complexity, especially if you take into account the number of lines it was written in. Well, that's everything. Thanks for listening. You can find the complete source code on my GitHub. The code you'll find there is a bit more complex than what I've shown you here today, because it also allows things like deferring class creations, etc., which brought its own set of problems. But it's kind of cool because you get to defer like a whole SQL Kimi model definition. You can make an instance out of it, write it to the database, all without even having SQL Alchemy imported. Of course, all of these actions are still deferred until an actual SQL Alchemy object becomes available. But still, according to me, it's pretty neat. If you've liked this presentation, you might also want to check out my other work, which you can also find on my GitLab. This is also the time where people plug in their Twitter and their Instagram, but unfortunately, I live under a rock and I don't have any of those. So, with these final words, I'll now pass the word to future me to answer some questions. Good luck, future me. Cheers!
So, thank you, Martin. So, no questions so far in the chat, but I think one of the main questions we probably have is what are the actual benefits from using this library? Is there any practical use case besides of initialization of Celery that you have in mind and where we could use this library for?
Yeah, as mentioned in the talk, it's not really used, or it's not really intended to be used for any production code or anything. I just wanted to try something. I had an idea. I wanted to write it. It sounded like a fun idea. I wrote it. I had a lot of fun writing it. I still think if you look at the example on the repository, it looks like a neat piece of code where I would even say intermediate Python developers would look at it and say, "Whoa, how does this work?" So it's more like an inspirational piece rather than functional use. That's what I would say.
And any specific construction that people might be interested in looking at, like if someone look at the code, is there something that they can take away, even if not the whole construct, but maybe some utility function or some helper that might be useful or reusable somewhere?
I think the true sighting is pretty neat, so that you can like have complete control over your get attribute, for instance, without running into recursion. I think it's a neat utility wrapper. I've got to be honest, it's been over a year, I think, since I wrote this library, so I don't know it by heart anymore, even though I wrote this presentation. I think there are a lot of neat stuff in there you can find, and it's probably more fun if you explore it yourself and play with it a bit. But as I hinted in the talk, you're gonna get burned if you run into bugs with the deferred object. Yeah, it's hard to debug.
And do you think it would be possible to have some sort of type inference in it? Because I suppose that it completely breaks the typing mechanism.
That's a good question.
And the type hints, but I've seen that you can these days have dynamic type inference. For example, in SQL Alchemy, they're doing that. Do you think it would be also possible to implement some sort of dynamic typing here?
I don't know. I would have to look into it. I have only surface level knowledge about typing in Python, so I don't think I'm fit to answer that.
All right. any other question from the audience that I can tell? Well, in any case, as Martin said, you can still have a look at his other projects, and you can go also after this session in the dedicated room where Martin can answer your questions. Thanks a lot, Martin, for your presentation. And I wish you a good FOSDEM, and see you next time then.
See you.